following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Okay, we left off yesterday talking about the transition from the period of judges, Samuel being the last of the judges, to King Saul. If you want to see the monarchy, exactly. We're right in the middle of living in the land of Israel, an 850-year period. We're going to talk about what is really the zenith of Jewish history. We're going to get through, hopefully, Saul, David, and Solomon. And that's the high point. Unfortunately, we should end on a high before Shabbos because it's going to take a big crash down afterwards. Now, I mentioned that the Jewish people ask for not the right kind of king. And we get a man who's not a bad person. God forbid. The Talmud is very clear that Saul is not only head and shoulders above everyone physically, he's head and shoulders above everyone morally and ethically. He's a wonderful human being, but he has a weakness. And the weakness, the Talmud says, his weakness is that he's not strict on having people honor him. He's not makpid on his kavod, so to speak. He has misplaced modesty. Oh, I'm nothing. You know, if God tells you to do a job, you don't start saying, oh, you have to recognize your truth. A real humble person recognizes his or her truth, strengths, and weaknesses. Saul is not really strong enough to be a leader of the Jewish people. And again, one of the great lessons we see in Jewish history, and especially at this period of time, it's going to become glaringly apparent, is the weakness, the problem caused by weak leadership. Now, Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin. Samuel is looking for a king. Saul, at the period of time, is definitely the best guy for the job. How does he end up being picked as king? It's a very interesting story. You know, the Talmud says that from the time of Moses to the destruction of the first temple, there were over 1 million prophets. It's an amazing concept. We'll talk about that a lot more in the next few classes because prophecy is going to end not too soon after this, a few hundred years later. Now, prophets in the ancient world, we know, the prophets we know are always talking about profound things, the end of days, major moral issues. But when you have literally thousands of prophets running around on all different levels of prophecy, like you have different professors in university, you have some big guys and some lesser guys, prophets could be used for anything. You know, you have a profound question about Jewish law, ask a prophet. Can't find the keys to your donkey? Ask a prophet. Matter of fact, you could use prophets to find lost objects. Saul loses some donkeys. He can't find them. So he goes to Samuel. It's pretty funny. He goes to the greatest prophet and asks, where's my donkey? And Samuel says to him, oh, your donkey is behind the shed. And by the way, takes a flask of oil, you're king of Israel. What does Saul go to do? He goes to hide. This is where you see the weakness of his character. If a prophet tells you you're king, you say, well, I'm a bit shocked, but I'll do the job. Who am I to argue with God? Now, Saul is crowned king, and again, he is a very righteous person. The Bible gives him sort of a bad PR, but if you really want to understand the real Saul, you have to look at what the commentators say and what the Talmud says. Now, Saul rules Jewish calendar dates, according to Christian chronology, 879 to 877 BCE. We only have 2 years of his rule here. Okay, he's not a king for a very long period of time. And he is a tragic figure in Jewish history. His brief reign is not marred by anything, is marred by all kinds of bad things happening. And he makes a fatal mistake early on. Now, there's a couple commandments that the Jewish people are commanded to do when they enter the land of Israel. One is to appoint a king, and to build a temple, and to wipe out Amalek. Amalek. You heard the nation of Amalek? We're going to talk about him a lot. I think we talked about Amalek yesterday. Did we mention Amalek at all? So Amalek is, again, this nation. It actually is descended from the Jewish people, from Esav, meaning, one of Jacob's twin brother there, Esau. We say Amalek is the arch enemy of the Jewish people. He has a pathological hatred for the Jews. To understand this commandment of killing Amalek, we have to focus on a little bit of what the Jewish understanding of the world is. We say initially there were 70 original nations, and just as the Jews, being descended from Abraham, have a certain national characteristics and drive which we inherit, a certain soul we get from Abraham, so too the different nations of the world. Amalek is that nation which is a hybrid form of anti-Semite, which hates God and therefore hates God's representative on earth, the Jewish people. Amalek's major ambition in life is to rid the world of the Jews and return the world to chance and idolatry and paganism and get rid of all that moral influence. Now, by the way, there's no nation of Amalek today. all those 70 original nations, the Talmud says, since the time of Sennacherib, the Assyrian emperor, more than 2,500 years ago, he mixed up all the nations. Today, you can't say these people are Moloch and those people are this nation or that nation. But we say the seeds, the descendants of these people will survive throughout history. Hold on a second, Max. The commandment says, Timche, it says, when you come into the land, whatever, Timche et zecher amalek mitachat hashamayim lo lishgach. That's what it's written in the Bible. Wipe out the remembrance of Amalek from under the face of the world. Don't forget. You're supposed to kill Amalek, meaning every member, every man, every woman, every child. You're supposed to kill all their animals. So no one will look at their cow and say that's Amalek's cow. Which is why, by the way, on Purim, you make noise when you hear Haman's name. Haman, who we'll get to later, a descendant of Amalek. Okay? You don't want to hear his name. Hitler, well, you can't prove it, but if anyone was in modern history, a descendant of Amalek, certainly Hitler had the Amalekite ideology perfectly down. I don't care if I take an entire nation with me, as long as I can take the Jews along. We'll get to Hitler much later. But going back to the Amalekites, okay, now, it should bother us when we hear, then maybe talk about this idea of a genocidal war. It's not a Jewish thing, as I mentioned yesterday. We taught the world value of life. We shouldn't be happy to kill people. But if the creator of the universe, as I said, says that it's a battle of good and evil, a cosmic struggle, kill these people or they'll kill you, you got to do what God says. As I said before, that old don't be more Catholic than the Pope thing, we make lots of mistakes in Jewish history. We're going to make one right now in this story because we think, or in this case, Saul thinks, or is weak, that he knows better. Okay, now again, today we don't go wiping out people. No, God doesn't speak to any of us. We don't have holy wars anymore. We don't have prophets. This is all this story is applicable to a different period of time in history when the spiritual reality and the connection to God was very different. Now, by the way, just to add on to this, of course, that we also don't learn Jewish law out from any sentences of the Bible. Jewish law comes from interpreting the oral law and following the chain of transmission. Okay, justice with an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, there's no instance in Jewish law where you blind someone or knock out their tooth because they did it to you. It's not Jewish law. Oral law says that it's monetary compensation. So too, any human being, even an Amalekite, there is not a human being on the planet Earth, no matter how evil his ancestry is, even an Amalekite can say, I, being a free-thinking human being with free will, realize that Amalek is totally wrong in his ideology. I choose, therefore, to leave the Amalekite nation. Not only that, I want to become Jewish. Any Amalekite can do it. So it's not like you have to kill these people, they have no choice. It's not, God forbid, to compare it to Hitler, who says, kill every Jew. Hitler didn't care. You could be three generations assimilated, married to Protestants in Germany. He would still wipe you out. It's not the same thing. Besides the fact that Hitler represents evil, we represent good. And to show you how true this is, the Talmud says that B'nai Banim Shel Haman, the grandchildren of Haman, who's the archenemy in the Purim story, descendant of Amalek, B'nai Banim Shel Haman, the grandchildren of Haman, Yoshvim V'lomdim V'yeshivot Shel B'nai Brak, are sitting and learning in the yeshivas of B'nai Brak. What do you mean that grandchildren of Haman are sitting and learning? Which means, first of all, that Amalekite descendants are not only still around, but they're Jewish, and they're learning in yeshiva. You know, according to Jewish tradition, is probably such a person? Rabbi Akiva. According to the Jewish tradition, descendants of converts, almost certainly from Amalek. If you want more on that, Rabbi Ari Khan has a whole class on it. Very interesting. So you have to understand that you don't learn a law from just reading a sentence. But we have to know what's going on here. This is the ultimate cosmic struggle. If you're going to be merciful and be nice to an Amalekite, even a little Amalekite, he's going to grow up, or his grandchildren are going to grow up and get into power, and what they're going to do is wipe you off the face of the earth. So again, a hard concept for us to appreciate today. But with the Holocaust, I think we can begin to appreciate that such an intense hatred can exist in the world, which will spare no one. This is Amalek. So, well... Now, Saul doesn't do land for peace, but what does Saul do? He gets a Jewish army together. He goes into battle. They win a huge victory. Now, this is a holy war here. Now, Jewish wars of conquest of the land of Israel were not rape and pillage and steal land wars and steal women wars and take gold and silver and animals. This was a war because it was commanded by God. It's righteous as war, unfortunately, can be. Okay? Samuel says to Saul, don't spare even the animals. The next day after the battle, Samuel goes to see Saul. And what does he hear? You know, meh, moo. You know, saying, what's going on? He goes to Saul and says, why are there animals running around outside the palace? And what does Saul say? He says, the people told me to spare the best of the Amalekites' animals to offer as thanks to God for winning the battle. And Samuel says, what did I tell you? You didn't listen. You're weak, the people say. You're the king. You say what I tell you to say, right? You do what I tell you to do. It's the will of God. This is the fatal flaw of a King Saul. And what does Samuel say to him? Remember we talked about this idea of responsibility? The higher your level of responsibility, the greater the implications for your actions and the greater the accountability and therefore punishment for your mistakes. I'll read you from 1 Samuel chapter 15, 26 to 28. It says, "And Samuel said to Saul, 'I shall not return to you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel.' And Samuel turned to go, and he seized the skirt of his robe, and he tore it." Meaning Saul grabs Samuel's garment, like, don't go, and he rips it. "And Samuel said to him, 'The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your fellow who is better than you.'" That's it. It's unbelievable. One mistake, he's finished, which doesn't mean he gets deposed and executed. But it means that his line will not carry on the monarchy. That's it. He doesn't get a second chance. This is heavy stuff. This is really heavy stuff. God doesn't mess around when you're in that position, king of Israel. Now what happens? Samuel the prophet goes to find who's going to be the next king. Now, kingship is supposed to come from Yehuda, the tribe of Judah. That's all going back to Jacob's blessing of Judah. The scepter will not depart from Judah's hand. So he goes down to the tribal portion of Judah, which is Jerusalem's on the border here, to the south. South of here into the Negev. And he goes to a place not far from here called Bethlehem. Bethlehem is the real name. Okay? And he goes to a man by the name of Yishai, Jesse as we call him. Now Jesse, now he's using prophecy here. It's like a homing device. He knows that the future king after Saul is going to come from this family. Now Jesse has 8 sons. The least impressive physically is a ruddy little guy with red hair by the name of David. You know, it's interesting. Jesse doesn't even want to bring David in from the field. You know, it's like you stay out in the field, you watch the sheep. It's like the Cinderella story, Lahavdil. You know, like the evil, we're not talking about the sons of David, David's brothers are not evil, but can you imagine the evil stepsisters trying to fit the glass slipper on their fat feet and poor Cinderella's out, you know, washing the floors. Samuel is looking at all of the sons and he sees they're all amazing, physically, Torah-wise, they're great fearers of God, they have tremendous potential, but he doesn't see any of them are going to be king. And he tells Jesse, he says, don't look at his appearance or stature, right? He says, right, a man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. Because then he sees David, and he sees that David, despite the fact that physically he's not so impressive, he's the great one. He's the one with the potential, which is, by the way, a very important lesson in Jewish history and how you're supposed to judge people. We live in a world today which is totally superficial. You are what you look like, which is why fashion and liposuction and plastic surgery and rhinoplasty and looking eternally young is such a big thing. God forbid you should look old. God forbid you're not perfect. You got to show your body off. Judaism says no. You tone down the outside, which is the whole Jewish laws of modesty, because the true individuality and the greatness of a human being is what they have inside them, not what they have outside. Gravity takes its toll on everyone eventually. Everything is going to sag, and eventually we're all going to die. And some people are just born with a little better, natural better looks than others. But real potential is what's internal, what's in the person's soul. Samuel takes a flask of oil and pours it on David's head. This is where the term Messiah comes from. The word comes from the Hebrew word moshach, which means to anoint. A prophet would pour oil. We have different examples of anointing vessels to be used in the temple when Moses is erecting the tabernacle in the wilderness. Here's two. A prophet would pour oil, that's what anointing means, on a person to show he's God's chosen, God's anointed one, which doesn't mean he becomes king right away, but he is the designated guy. Okay, designated pitcher. He's the guy who's up and he's warming up in the bullpen there. He's going to be the guy who's going to take over. Okay, so very, very interesting story here. Now, what goes on is an interesting story of the Philistines, who I mentioned before, are still around the time of Saul. Saul is fighting the Philistines. There's an interesting battle scene described in, this is all in the book of Samuel here. David's 3 older brothers are fighting in Saul's army against the Philistines. Now, ancient warfare, we know, is highly ritualized. You ever read the Iliad? In the Iliad, which is the world's greatest battle epic, certainly in the ancient world, the Siege of Troy, the Greeks versus the Trojans, and they'd be sieging the city for 10 years until they think of that, you know, horse to hide inside and roll it in the city. You look at the Iliad and you see the great champions on either side would always go for each other. You know, they fight like Hector fights Ajax, you know, and then they slash their way through all the lesser guys and they get to each other and they fight. This is a very common idea in ancient warfare. Each side would often present a champion. And those champions would fight each other, and often the battle would end with that, because whichever champion won, the other side would be so demoralized, they'd go away. The Philistines have a champion who's a pretty awesome guy. His name is Goliath. And he's huge. He's gigantic. You know, they used to have in worldwide wrestling a guy by the name of Andre the Giant. I remember seeing this guy. I was like, awe. He's 7'5", 450 pounds. What do you call that guy? Anything he likes. Okay? He used to wrestle three guys at once. The Philistines had a guy who's even bigger. He has like a telephone pole for a spear. Now, the Jews are on one side, and the Philistines are on the other. You can go south of Jerusalem. You see the place where the battle takes place. It's this valley. Jews are on one side, Philistines on the other. And Goliath is marching out in front of the Philistine lines, walking back and forth, saying horrible things about our mothers, cursing the Jewish God. Now, David is too young to be in the army. He's a teenager. He's too young. But he shows up with food for his brothers. Okay? And David's shocked because all the Jews are like, ding, they're all petrified. They're not going to, you know, they're not, no one wants to go fight this guy. And David, he's outraged. He says, how dare you let this uncircumcised dog curse the living God? And everyone's like, what are you going to do about it? He goes, I'll go take care of him. So they give David like this big coat of armor, you know, forget it. He can't wear it, this huge sword. He can't schlep it. He goes out, like all good Jewish leaders, he's a shepherd, right? He goes out with his little sling, and slings, by the way, are not little insignificant weapons. Slings are used, all ancient armies use slingers as well as archers and spear throwers. Sorry, but he used, yeah, scare away wolves and lions or whatever. They had lions here back then, believe it or not. Scare away wild animals, okay, from attacking the sheep. So David goes and picks up three smooth stones from the brook. He goes out to face this giant guy, Goliath. And Goliath says, you know, here, shrimp, come here so I can deliver your body up to the birds of the heaven. You can be like, you know, bird food by this in a few minutes. And David says, you're going to be dog food in a few minutes. And he says, you come at me with your big spear. I come at you with the power of the living God. And he throws this rock, hits Goliath in the head. Goliath goes down. David cuts off his head. Philistines freak out and run. Jews win a huge victory. They chase the Philistines. They slaughter them. It's a tremendous victory. Now, by the way, David's saying, what David says is very powerful. It says that true strength of the Jewish people is not lo b'koch b'lo b'chayil, right? It's not by strength and not by might, but rather with my spirit. Very famous quote. Okay, the strength of the Jewish people is always that God fights with us. We have to remember that. When we lose sight of that, we're in big trouble. We'll see it when we get to modern Israeli history, 1967, great victory, and then the 73 war. Okay? It's a very interesting thing you see. We have to always remember where the source of our strength comes from. David, overnight, becomes superhero. They start singing a song about him. Saul killed 1,000 and David killed 10,000. He's like this, you know. Now, what is it? You know, look at all Grimm's fairy tales. What do you get, like the guy who kills the giant? What does he get as a reward? He gets to marry the princess. David gets as his bride Michal, second oldest daughter of Saul. And Saul says, come work for me. Now David works as Saul like it is an aide. He also, Saul seems to have some sort of like serious migraine problem or some sort of dementia. David, he like loses it. And David would play for him. He's a musician. And it would soothe Saul. Saul gets really, I'm running through this quickly because we're not going to spend, it's not a class on the book of Samuel. Saul gets insanely jealous of David. He tries to kill him. David has to flee for his life. And Saul goes chasing him all over the country. He's obsessed with this. On some level, he knows he's good, you know.
This is Saul, the deposed king.
He's not deposed. He's the soon to die and therefore not be king anymore. King. Once you're dead, it doesn't bode well for your future as king. David has to go into hiding. There's a lot of very interesting stories about what Saul does. He even kills out all the Kohanim in the city of Nov for hiding David. It's really bad news. I mean, Saul's a little bit out of control here. Again, you read the Bible, he sounds terrible. He's nowhere near as bad as you think he is. The final end of King Saul is one of the most interesting stories in the Bible, also in the book. He goes to fight the Philistines again. Where does the battle take place? At Mount Gilboa. You know Mount Gilboa is? It's up north, near the Galilee. It's amazing how far the Philistines were approaching into the country. They're no longer on the coast. They're actually hanging out on what is the major trade route in the ancient Near East, the King's Highway. We're going, turning in from the coast, going up through Mount Gilboa, up to Beit Shan, and then up to Damascus. They're really, and not strategically, they're in a bad place for the Jewish people. Saul marches out with his army to go fight the Philistines. Now, by this period of time, Samuel, his prophet, is dead. Samuel dies at 52. Now, all the leaders at the time relied on prophets. Many of them were prophets themselves to give them advice about what's the will of God, what will be. Saul, before going into battle, would know from Samuel, God says you're going to win. That's a very, you know, soothing thought there. You're going to win the battle. Could you imagine knowing you're going to win the battle? Saul is petrified. He doesn't know what to do. Now, Saul, being an incredibly righteous king that he was, had rid the land of Israel of all idolatry. Any witches were put to death. Any Asherah or Baal Peor worshipped. But now he doesn't know how to con. He wants to find out what's going to be. It's a great story. He goes at night. He disguises himself. And he goes and finds a witch at a place called Endor, which is near Mount Tabor. And he says, knocks on the door, and he goes, I need to speak to a witch. And he goes, are you kidding? If Saul finds out, I'm dead. Little does she know, she's talking to Saul. He goes, I need you to bring, you know, Sam. He says, I promise nothing will happen to you. I need you to bring Samuel the prophet back. It's the coolest story. Like, make a great movie out of this one. They bring Samuel back from the dead, and he's like, why have you disturbed my sleep? You know? And Saul says, what's going to happen? And Samuel says, know that you will surely die. It's pretty heavy. Now, you'd think any normal person, like on our level, would go run. Like, I'm going to go to Florida. Forget it. I'm out of here. You know? Saul goes into battle the next day. Okay? And he is wounded. And he commits suicide, basically. He knows that the Philistines are going to, like, rip him to shreds and have a lot. He and his three sons, including Yonatan, who is David's best friend, who is supposed to be the next king after Saul, they all die in battle. Okay? The Philistines take Saul. They decapitate him. They send his head on tour, which is the standard thing you did after a big battle. They hang his body on, and the body of his three sons on the walls of the city of Beit She'an, where you can go see. There's a big tell, a big mound where the city used to be today. You go to the excavations. The Jews come back at night. They steal the headless body down. They bury it. The Jewish people are left kingless. So after Saul's short reign, Samuel's gone, Saul's gone, no king. Not such a good situation. Saul does have a surviving son by the name of Ish-Boshet, who sort of assumes the role of leadership and is actually murdered by some Jews who think that who want to ingratiate themselves with David. David is not pleased at all by that, by the way. David is not interested in having people, does not support anyone killing other people off for his benefit. But the Jewish people are basically left kingless. David, meanwhile, who reappears down in the south in Hebron, is going to be crowned king. Now, I'll give you the David statistics. David is born in 907 BCE and he dies in 837. So we're talking about the 9th century before the Common Era. He lives to the age of 70. He reigns from 877 to he reigns from 877 to 870 as king of Yehuda. For 7 years, he's declared king by the tribe of Yehuda. And then for the remaining 33 years, he rules as king of Israel. Okay, as a whole Jewish people. So 40 years he's basically king, but part of that time he's not really recognized as king of the whole Jewish people. Okay, but obviously David, who's anointed by Samuel, he's the man who's going to do the job. And David is a tremendous, tremendous person in Jewish history. He really is. Now, of course, as you mentioned with Samson before, modern Zionists, you wanted to create a new image of a Jew who is not the Torah scholar, but the macho leader guy who takes command, a nationalist Jew. They glorify people like David. David, Solomon, especially David, is a warrior king. Samson, Judah, Maccabee. These are guys, by the way, who the Crusaders, who of course slaughtered all the Jews of Europe, also glorify. They get the idea of the chivalric leader, you know, the pious warrior fighting for God. This is King David. Okay. Now, the Jewish view of King David is, yes, he was a military leader of par excellence, but his greatness is in who he is spiritually. First of all, he's a king and a prophet, which is very, very rare. Generally, kings do not have prophecy in Jewish history. It's very dangerous to give a king prophecy. He'll wake up one morning and say, God told me last night to raise taxes 300%. You can argue with him. But David is on such a high level, he earns the position of prophecy, and he keeps it. And again, if you read superficially the stories of the Bible about David, you can get a very wrong impression of him. Now, David is not perfect. He makes some mistakes. We'll talk about some of the David and Bathsheba story, things like that. But he is an incredible character in Jewish history. His true strength is not his military strength. His true strength is his spiritual strength. Okay? He's a real man who fears God and has a close relationship with God. He wrote the Psalms, by the way, which most of the Psalms, those prayers we read they're like poetry, they're beautiful, but they have very profound meaning to them. Most of them are the product of King David. He's also a musician. He's a Renaissance guy. He plays music. He fears God. He's a military leader. Boy, he's an impressive guy. Impressive guy, King David. He subdues all of the nations around Israel that pose a threat. He gets rid of the Philistine threat. Now, by the way, we know historically, to zoom out for a second, now, the story of Israel during this entire period of time, from the Exodus onward, is the story of us being sandwiched between the two great ancient civilizations, Mesopotamia in the east, which will either be the Assyrians, Babylonians, or Persians, or in the west, the Egyptians. During this period of time, there's a window of opportunity for David, meaning that Egypt, we know this is just world history, a known fact. During this period of time, both Egypt and Assyria go into significant decline. They're not in any position to expand and create world empires, which leaves this sort of vacuum in the middle where Israel is for Israel to expand unmolested by these other great empires. And David and Solomon are going to capitalize on that and build a little mini empire. So David comes to power, unites the Jewish people, and he says, now that the Jewish people have a king from whom all future kings will come, including the Messiah. Very important to focus on this. The notion of Messiah, which the Christians are going to later pervert into their own idea, is nothing more, or nothing less, I should say. This is not a small job description, than a direct descendant of King David, the house of David, Beit David, from the tribe of Judah, the tribe of nobility, from the family of nobility. This is the noble family of the Jewish people, who will bring about the redemption, meaning will bring all the Jewish people back to the land of Israel, rebuild the temple, and bring the whole world to a recognition of one God and elevate all humanity to this ideal of living together under God with peace and justice and brotherhood. That's the Messiah. A human being, though, none of the Son of God stuff. Okay, David says, now that we have the royal family of Israel from whom ultimately the Redeemer will come, now we need a capital city. Okay, which is, and now we need to build a permanent resting place for the house of God. Okay, so what does David do? He sends his general. Now, the city of Jerusalem, for 450 years since the time the Jewish people entered the land of Israel, to the time of King David, is one of those little Canaanite enclaves that the Jews never conquered. It's inhabited by a bunch of people, a Canaanite tribe called the Yebusi, the Jebusites. David, now, the city where it stands geographically, it actually is to the south of outside the old city today. If you go outside Dungate, you go to the Arab village of Silwan, which is the southernmost spur of the mountain that is Mount Moriah, where the gold dome sits on. It's surrounded by a wall. It has a water. It has a spring outside the wall. David's general Yoav, according to the description, somehow he climbs up the water tunnel. Archaeologists who found the water system there like to describe, maybe this is where he climbed. We don't know at all. He enters the gate. He opens the gates of the city. David's army enters, and he conquers the city. And then he buys the upper area of the hill, which is today in back of the western wall, for the place where the temple will be rebuilt. Now, the question you have to deal with for a few minutes is, why Jerusalem? Think about it. You know, if you wanted to put a capital city in the land of Israel, Jerusalem is probably the worst place you could put it, except maybe Beersheba. And even Beersheba is better because it's on a trade route. Okay? You know, think about it. Where are all capital cities in the world or major cities in the world built on, near, or by?
Water.
Lakes, rivers, or at least a major trade route. Jerusalem is not near any major body of water. And it's not... Yeah, that's a cool thing. You look from heaven, you look up from the satellite picture, it looks like a giant shin, one of the names of God. But that's not the reason why. Like, they weren't up in the sky looking down saying, whoa, cool, you know, like geography. You can't see that, by the way, today so easily. It's not such a... But anyway, the reason why Jerusalem has to do with a very unique aspect of Jewish national identity. We're not near any major trade route. And there are big trade routes here, by the way. There's the King's Highway, which is one of the major trade routes in the ancient Near East, which runs from the Gulf of Aqaba, the Red Sea area, down up the Jordan Valley, which is a huge natural fault line, up to Damascus. And there's also Via Maris, which is the way of the sea, which runs up through the area of Gaza along the coast of the Mediterranean. South of Mount Carmel, it turns in, runs by Mount Tabor to Beit Shan and into Syria. Okay? Or it should have been on the Mediterranean. Ideally, a place like Jaffa would have been great. It's on the trade route on the Mediterranean. Why Jerusalem? The reason why Jerusalem has to do with a very unique facet of who we are as a people. Okay? The Jewish people, look how we become a nation. Where did the Jewish people become a nation? How do other nations form? Nations become nations by living in a piece of real estate for a long period of time. They develop a common language and a common taste in food. Like the French woke up one day and said, ah, I like brie cheese and white wine, you know? No, they lived in a place and developed a common national identity based on land, language, history, culture. We become a nation outside our national homeland at Mount Sinai. What makes us a nation? It's not deciding we're all going to eat bagels on Sunday or Chinese food. What makes us a nation is we all dedicate ourselves to doing the will of God and keeping Torah. As it says, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will obey. Okay? Therefore, our national capital will reflect this unique aspect of Jewish identity, which is the spiritual idea, the relationship with God. And there is no better place on the planet Earth to relate to God than Jerusalem. Why? Let's look at the... When I say Jerusalem, we're talking about not the whole city, you know, David's Tower. We're talking about Mount Moriah. And back that mountain, which is not the highest mountain, but it's the holiest mountain, in back of the Western Wall underneath the Gold Dome today. That site in Jewish consciousness, first of all, metaphysically, Kabbalistically, the stone of Mount Moriah is called the Evan Shtiah. What's Shtiah in Hebrew? Ani rotzeh lishtot. Drinking stone. Drinking water and spirituality are synonymous often, right? Mayim Chayim Torah. The world, we say, is spiritually nourished from that spot. That is the place where God's presence can be felt more intensely than any other place on the planet Earth. Which is why when Abraham, in the story of the Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, wants to find the place where he's supposed to carry out this very difficult command of God, he's walking around, he sees God's presence spiritually. He's spiritually sensitive. He's a prophet resting on the spot. Isaac comes to pray here. Jacob, of his dream of the ladder going into heaven, goes into heaven at the spot. In Jewish collective historical consciousness, this is the place where God's presence can be felt more intensely than anywhere else. And therefore, it's the logical place to build a permanent resting spot for the most holy object the Jewish people have. What's the object? The tabernacle, the Mishkan. Now remember, we build it in the desert. We schlep it around with us for 40 years in the desert. When we come into the land of Israel, that Mishkan is in four different locations over a 450-year period. First, it's in a place called Gilgal. And then for most of the time, like 380 years, it's in a place called Shiloh, Mishkan Shiloh. Then it's in a place called Nov. And finally, the last place it goes is a place called Givon. Okay, now Givon, actually, I live in a place called Givat Ze'ev, which is past Ramot on the way to Tel Aviv, on one of the major back roads going up to Jerusalem. Across from where I live is the Arab city of, Arab village of El Jib. One of the nice things you can say about the Arabs living here for the last hundreds of years is they preserved many of the ancient place names. El Jib has a tel. A tel is a mound, which is the buried remains of previous civilizations. That's where archaeologists like to excavate. El Jib is considered to be the biblical city of Givon, which is not very far from here, actually. So David conquers the city. He buys the upper part of the mountain, which is outside the walls of the Jebusite city. Why does he buy it? He says, so in future, no one will claim we stole it, we took it by force. There are three places in the land of Israel which are bought. Anyone know what they are, three places? We just read about one, right? Right. Shechem, right. The city of Shechem in the north, which is today Nablus, the cave of Machpelah, Hebron in the south, and the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. So the people won't claim we stole it. Of course, today, it doesn't make a difference whether you do the right thing as a Jew. The three places which we bought legally are precisely the three places that have the highest concentrations of Arabs in Israel, and precisely three places which they, of course, want and won't let us have: Jerusalem, Shechem, and Hebron. So it's interesting. Now, David brings the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. It's a very interesting scene where he dances before it at the end of the book of Samuel, and his wife, he has more than one wife, but Michal, you know, Saul's daughter, mocks him. He says, how can you, king, like, dance in front of the Ark? You know, it's not dignified. And as punishment for that, by the way, she dies childless. You don't mock the king of Israel. The king of Israel is a serious thing. Okay. David is an incredible person. He's not allowed to build a temple, however. He gathers all the materials together. He brings the Ark into Jerusalem. Why can't he build a temple? A number of reasons are given. One of the ideas is the temple is a house of God and a house of peace, and David had a lot of blood on his hands from subduing the enemies of the Jews, and such a person shouldn't build a temple. I don't think that's quite fair. There's a nicer reason I like. I'm not sure exactly what the story means, but it's an interesting point about David and how God works. God says to David, you know, I know eventually that you guys are going to blow it, and I'm going to have to pour out my wrath. There's a mathematical formula here. You have to be punished for things you do wrong. Okay, and if you build that temple, it's going to be such a holy structure, I won't be able to destroy it. I'll have to destroy the Jewish people instead. And I would rather destroy the temple than the Jewish people. So you don't build it. Now, I want to talk about one more story of David. David and Bathsheba. Okay, it's one of the most misread stories. Simple reading of the story. David, you know, he's sitting on the roof of his palace one night. He looks out onto the roof of one of the next houses and he sees a beautiful woman bathing. He finds out that the woman is married to one of his generals, Uriah the Hittite. Whether he's a Hittite, we're not sure. He just comes from the Hittites. You don't know. He comes from the land of the Hittites. David falls in love with Bathsheba and basically arranges that Uriah will be put out in front of battle and be killed so that David could take his wife. What happens next? It's the prophet, I believe, Nathan, comes to David and says, he tells him this very interesting story. There was this rich guy who had a huge flock of sheep. There was this poor little guy who had one little ewe. One little sheep he treated like his kid. No puns intended there, kid, can you know? He treated like his only child, you know? And one day the rich guy says, I'm going to have a big feast. I need some meat. So what does he do? He takes the little guy who has the one little sheep and he kills it. And David is furious. He goes, let me at that guy. He's in trouble. And Nathan says, that's you. Well, it's yous and kids, boils. That's you. What does David say? You want to show? David says, I've sinned before God. Now, first of all, look at David's reaction and Saul's reaction. Saul is, the people told me to do it. Great people who make mistakes recognize that they are responsible. To quote Harry Truman, the buck stops here. That's number one point. Number two is, by the way, what's going on in that story is very, very different from the simple reading. Okay, the Talmud says, if you think that's what David did and he sinned that way, you're totally wrong. He did something wrong, but it wasn't like soap opera, lusty, powerful king going after some other guy's wife. There's a lot more going on there. Uriah disobeys the king. He should have got the death penalty. All Jewish soldiers, by the way, who go into war in biblical times, all gave their wives gets. They all divorced them and said, ahead of time. And if I don't come back from battle, why would you do that? You know, in Jewish law, if your husband disappears, you're an aguna. You're stuck forever and you can never remarry. There's a lot going on. And it wasn't just like David had a bunch of good lawyers finding loopholes for him to do what he did. He does make a mistake, but you can't read the story in a simple way. We'd spend hours talking about that story. It is fascinating. But there's much more going on. David is not perfect, but boy, is he a great human being. Much greater than Saul. Fantastic human being. And he brings the Jewish people up to an incredible level of unity, of preparing to build the temple. Now, before he dies, okay, he, at the very end of the book of Samuel, he appoints as his successor. And he has a lot of problems in his life, but he's punished. His son Absalom rebels against him, and he's killed. The first son, who's born from Bathsheba, this woman who is Uriah's wife, dies. The second son is Solomon, which is clear indication that David knows in a prophetic level this is meant to be his wife. And the person who's going to succeed him as king is going to come from this relationship. So it's obviously not a relationship a relationship that is divinely ordained. Although how David does it, obviously on some level he did it in the wrong way. Yeah.
Yeah, because that first child was born out of their illicit relationship.
Right.
And died because of that.
Well, it wasn't an illicit relationship. She wasn't married, so it wasn't like he was not an adulterer at the time. But the problem is what he did had an element of something wrong in it, but it's not the way we read it. And he has a very tragic life, David. And he never complains, by the way. He always says, "I'm doing too well in this world. I'm worried about what my next world is going to be like." Tremendous, tremendous character. He is what a Jewish leader is supposed to be. Now, before David dies, he appoints as his son, Solomon. And I want to give you the closing speech. This is 1 Kings 2, 2 through 3. David says, and this is the greatness of David. This is the classic blessing that Jews give their children at their bar mitzvah. Okay? "I go the way of all the earth. You shall be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes and his commandments and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn." And that's a great lesson for all of us. The classic way to prosper in Judaism is to just keep Torah, and we won't have problems. Now, Solomon is crowned king. Solomon is born in 848. He dies in 796 at the age of 52, just like Samuel. By the way, Solomon is made king at 12 years old. He's a very young king. Okay? And he is, I just want to read from 1 Kings 2, 1 through 12. "And the days of David drew near, and he should die. And he charged Solomon his son." We read through the whole thing, I just said now. "And Solomon sat upon the throne of David his father, and his kingdom was firmly established." And then it goes on to say that Solomon was wisest, chacham mikol adam, wisest of all the men. And it says in 1 Kings chapter 5, 9 through 15, "And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceedingly much, and largeness of heart as the sand that is on the seashore. And he was wiser than all men, and they came from all the nations to hear the wisdom of Shlomo," from all the kings of the earth. This is the Jewish ideal. We have to understand that when we get to Solomon, we have a great king who's followed by another great king, which is very unusual. Many great people do not have children that could follow in their father's footsteps. Solomon is such a person. This is the ideal state. The Jewish people have a king who has unified the Jewish people. Okay? And the whole world is coming to learn from him. This is what the Jewish people are supposed to be. Solomon's greatness was not just in Torah wisdom. It was in secular knowledge, how the world functions, science. Okay? The whole world comes to learn from Solomon. This is what the Jewish people are supposed to do. This is what the Messianic era is all about. We teach the world by example. They come and want to learn from us. Now, during the reign of Solomon and David, no converts. The Sanhedrin would not allow anyone to convert to Judaism. Why not? Because it's so obvious that the Jews had their act together that a lot of people want to join us. Like today, a lot of Russians who aren't even Jewish are trying to get exit permits to Israel because it's so much nicer to live in Israel than the Soviet Union with all its economic problems. How much more so back then when the Jewish people were really being a light to nations? You want to convert to Judaism. And the reason why it is so hard to convert to Judaism is because you got to show that you love truth and you're doing it despite the pain. No pain, no gain, which is why conversion to Judaism is in essence a commitment. If you try and convert today, you go to the rabbinute in Israel. You know, Israel bureaucracy is bad. The rabbinute is the worst. You open up a folder with them to convert. They'll lose it all on purpose. You go back, they lose it again. until the moment, I know I have several friends who are converts, until the moment you get there, they're trying to make it hard for you. Don't do it. You don't want this. Turn back, go, and then you go to the mikveh and you convert, and suddenly, you know, everyone got the bagels and the lox and a big kiddush. Welcome to the Jewish people. Judaism is commitment. That's Abraham onward. Okay? You can't do it because it's obvious and easy, like in the time of David and Solomon. No converts allowed. So if you know anyone who wants to convert, by the way, I highly recommend you tell them to open up a file with the rabbi now. You never know when Messiah is going to come. And once he comes, in the Messianic era, also no converts allowed. Not when it's obvious and easy that we're right. Now, that's number one point. We see how on a high level we're at. It says also Solomon. Now, what's his fault he's criticized for? It says Solomon had 1,000 wives, 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now, this is not, God forbid, because Solomon's like Hugh Hefner. He's some, like, you know, some big Middle Eastern potentate with a big libido, and he needs to have millions of women. We're talking about a great man spiritually. What's, hold on. Imagine what his phone bills were like, 700 wives. And he's probably saying, thank God they didn't have credit cards back then. What is the purpose of marriage in the throughout human history amongst nobility and wealthy people? Not at all. No, amongst nobility. Amongst nobility is not to create, it's to create offspring, but it's to make political alliances and keep money in power within a very few families. This is without, there's almost no marriages for love amongst monarchies in human history. Marriages for alliances.
Yeah, but there's marriages for pleasure as well.
Yeah, people would. Yeah, Henry VIII, he definitely. But there was no, basically, no, Henry VIII is a great example of a guy who wanted to produce a male heir. He was bumping off wives right and left. They would keep all kinds of things going on, but the major reason for marriage, World War I, okay, we have Nicholas. We have Nicholas II. We have King George of England and the Kaiser Wilhelm. They're all first cousins, grandchildren of Queen Victoria. They're writing letters to each other and calling each other Nicky and Willie as 8 million people were dying in World War I. I always say it's so unfair. All these wealthy people marry wealthy people. You know, why don't they spread it around a little? Marry some poor people. Give someone a chance to buy a nice car, you know? This is what happens in human history, and it makes sense. If Solomon is such a wise man and the Jews are leading the world, then every little city-state in the world, there was a lot of ancient city-states then, would all want to send Solomon a daughter to marry, to make an alliance with. But that's wrong. It says that the king of Israel shouldn't have too much gold and too many horses and too many wives. Maximum of 18. And nowadays, we only have one. To stay married to one woman is hard enough nowadays. Can you imagine what the women think about the men? It's a mistake. As a matter of fact, it's a mistake to such an extent that the Bible says that King Solomon in his old age worshipped idols. Now, here's a classic case of a grossly disproportionate level of criticism. You can be sure that King Solomon never thought for one nanosecond to worship idols. But you could be sure that even though no one was allowed to convert, King Solomon's wives were converted so they could marry him. And you could be sure that several of them did not convert wholeheartedly and kept a little Getchkala idol somewhere in a closet somewhere. For a wife of King Solomon to worship idols, that's unacceptable. The greatest leader of the Jewish people, a man on his level, it's going to be written in the Bible, King Solomon worships idols. And you could be sure that King Solomon up there in Shamayim in heaven is suffering eternal pain knowing that that's written about him in the Bible. Now, the other amazing thing that King Solomon does, which besides preserving the unity of the Jewish people and teaching the world in 40 years of uninterrupted peace and prosperity, unbelievable. Think of the Middle East today, in the last 50 years, 40 years of peace, he builds the temple. He's allowed to do it. Okay? David was not allowed, Solomon does. And I want to read you the description. We're going to end on this. It says, this is 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 6 through 28. And the priest brought the ark of the Lord to its place and to the sanctuary of the house, to the most holy. Then Solomon said, the Lord said that he would dwell in darkness. I have surely built you a house to dwell in, a settled place for you to dwell in forever. But will God indeed dwell on earth? Behold, the heaven and the heavens' heavens cannot contain you, much less this temple which I have erected. And you shall turn toward your servant in prayer and to his supplications, O Lord my God, to hearken to the song and to the prayer that your servant is praying before you today. This is the pinnacle of Jewish history. Everyone united, okay? Everyone wanting to learn from the Jews. Peace, prosperity, all the Jewish institutions in place. A king from the house of King David, a high priest, a permanent resting place, a capital city. This is as good as it gets for the Jewish people. Now, this is the beginning of what we call the first temple period. Bayit Rishon. The word Beit HaMikdash, a lot of different words are used to describe this period. Bayit Rishon means the first house. That is a building that is going to stand for 410 years. An amazing period of time. 410 years we had this structure in Jerusalem. Okay? That's going to be the central religious spiritual site of the Jewish people. This is the zenith. Now, unfortunately, and I'm going to end here because let's end on a high note before Shabbos. Unfortunately, it's not going to continue this way. Because, you know, we're talking about the story of weak leadership. The next king after King Solomon is not going to be a great man like Solomon. He's going to be weak. His name is going to be Rehoboam, one of Solomon's sons. And rather than elevate the Jewish people the next step up, and believe me, if the next king had been someone of the stature of David and Solomon, there's no question in my mind that that would have been it. That would have been the Messianic era. The whole world would be different. Now, what ifs are very dangerous to do in history. You know, they say not even God can change history, only historians can. We're not changing anything here. But unfortunately, we're going to see the reality is going to be very different. So we'll end at the beginning of the first temple period, which is really the beginning of the end of what is the high point of Jewish history. Okay, guys, thank you very much.
This program is part of a series. For the continuation, please insert the next disc.